Lava, welcome to Dateline from RNZ Pacific. I'm Ben Robinson-Drawbridge. Coming up, drug trafficking on the rise in the Pacific. Fears COVID-19 could wipe out PNG's Daru. Grim revelations in the trial of a Samoan man charged with human trafficking. Bougainville's president pushes constitutional change for a third term and disposing of a delicacy in Fiji. A United Nations report says drug trafficking through the Pacific Islands is of increasing concern and has suggested countries sign up to international control treaties to help combat drug-related organised crime in the region. The International Narcotics Control Board has released its annual report on the movement of drugs, including precursor chemicals for illicit drugs. Board member and University of New South Wales Professor Richard Mattock told Kurovaka Uta why the drugs are a concern.
Well, until recent years, the Pacific Island states were largely devoid of really potent drugs. Certainly, there's been cannabis available and other drugs for ceremonial purposes, shall we say, carver and such. But now there's a movement of drugs across the Pacific, particularly from Colombia through the Pacific Island states to New Zealand and Australia, and also from Asia coming down, avoiding going directly into Australia, but coming through the Pacific Island states. And that movement of illegal drugs, particularly cocaine, but to a certain extent methamphetamine, is meaning that the Pacific Island states are becoming more involved in illegal drug use. There's a further issue, which is that as countries like Australia and New Zealand deport Pacific Island citizens who committed a crime back to their countries, those individuals take with them expertise, contacts, etc., about drug movements. And that's creating increased use in the Pacific Island states, not hugely, but there is increased use and increased concerns among the states. There's increasing concern about particularly meetings of the Pacific Island law officers networks, and there's meetings of the Transnational Serious Organised Crime Pacific Task Force in Fiji, New Zealand, Tonga. These groups are focusing on the movement of illegal drugs particularly.
Obviously, in terms of the geography, you know, it's a hard area to police. But I note in the report that's also talking about the low adherence to three international drug control treaties as also not helping the situation, if you like. Can you speak to that about these conventions and how that could improve things?
Yeah, there are three conventions or treaties which about 200 of the 210-ish territories or nations globally have signed on to. There are only about 10 countries which have not signed on. Seven of those countries are in the Pacific. That's to do with infrastructure and capacity historically. But now there's a sense that the Pacific Island states need to sign these treaties because it helps them. It firstly helps them to develop local laws, because once the treaties are signed, then local laws mirror the treaties, and that allows for prosecution either locally or extradition to another country, say New Zealand or to Australia. It also provides the countries with a very different set of information, and that is that there are very good operational platforms which are used by police and customs globally, and the Pacific Island states can then start to use those platforms to document and be aware of movements. So it increases the capacity of the Pacific Island countries to understand the movement of drugs and then to provide infrastructure to detect drug movements, but also to prosecute. It gives them a lot of expertise from the global community.
Have you guys noted that there is a fact that there is now more attention being put to this issue?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think the Pacific Island states are really stepping up the mark in many ways, and our report in no way is critical of them. It's, we recognise fully the problems with capacity. But we also recognise that they're quite vulnerable to a couple of things. And one is, once drugs start to move through a country, there tends to be leakage of the drugs into that country for a number of reasons. And that means that the countries are at risk of developing regular illegal drug users who will then seek further drugs, and that will deteriorate the communities and bring harms. So it makes a lot of sense for Palau, for Tonga, for Samoa, other countries to start to step up to the mark. But also the Pacific Island Police Group, they've been putting in place Pacific action plans.
Professor Richard Mattock says addressing illegal drugs should also be done through a human rights framework, including addiction therapy to protect people's freedom and integrity. The mayor of Papua New Guinea's Daru says his neglected frontier town could be wiped out by the COVID-19 coronavirus if it arrives there. There are unconfirmed reports of the virus nearby in Western Province, prompting a travel ban between Australia's Torres Strait Islands and PNG. The mayor, Samuel Wingu, says Daru was ravaged by cholera 10 years ago and now has problems with tuberculosis and leprosy. He says without running water and a sewerage system for the town's exploding population, conditions are ripe for an outbreak.
The town was a colonial town designed to hold 5,000 people. But now the population of the town has exploded to over 20,000, almost 30,000 people. Most of these people who have flooded into Daru town are from the Fly River. That is where the giant Octadia gold and copper mine, the mine tailings has affected them. Their villages have been destroyed and a lot of these people have migrated to Daru. And the town basically has no reliable running water. We do not have sewerage and everybody, relieves themselves in the bushes and in the sea, and all the infrastructure in this town is literally falling apart, especially our road systems. Also, the only radio communication that we have here has already stopped. NBC, owned by the government of Papua New Guinea. I think the NBC will soon be condemned by the health authorities. The prison that we have here has been condemned, and they're now in the process of trying to transfer the prisoners out to other jails around the country. Our police barracks that we have will also soon to be condemned, as well as our local post office that we have has already been condemned. Even our schools too are also affected. And while we speak, we don't have power. We don't have regular power supply. We have been having power that's been rationed. We only receive power only a few hours in the night, and during the daytime, we don't receive power. And, our school children are also affected. They cannot sit inside a classroom properly. Fans won't be on so that the children can sit in a comfortable environment for learning purpose. And teachers are also, forced to suspend classes too early. Most of the public servants are not at work because they cannot do what is required using power. It also affects our hospital. We also need power to run machines, that equipment that is needed in the hospital. Basically, power is also another problem. Power, water. Previously, we had the cholera sickness that came. Cholera wiped out more than 400 people on record some years back. Also, now we have a big tuberculosis problem. Although we have partners here who try to give some assistance to help to mitigate the problem, but we really have not been successful with the tuberculosis. And whilst we are on that, just last week, I attended a meeting, and in that meeting, I was informed that Daru town alone is sitting on the number one position as far as leprosy is concerned. That has made me fear for the worst, and now that we have the coronavirus now sweeping through the planet. This town is a strategic town, and we are sharing two international borders, Australia to the south and Indonesia to the west. And if anything happens across the Indonesian border, people, they move freely in and out of, their traditional hunting ground. They go in and out, and whilst they are moving in and out, they may be also bringing in sicknesses. And in the event that the coronavirus arrives in Daru, I really fear for the worst, because once it hits the town, it's going to absolutely do a clean sweep.
That was Daru Mayor Samuel Wingu. A Samoan man who prosecutors say was trafficked to New Zealand and used as a slave has described being ordered to beat his cousin by his adoptive father, the Hastings-based Samoan chief who brought him here. The trial of Joseph Ounga Matamata is in its third week at the High Court in Napier. He denies 24 charges of human trafficking and slavery involving 13 Samoan nationals over a 26-year period. Anusha Bradley reports.
The man, along with his two younger cousins, was adopted by Mr. Matamata in Samoa in June 2016. They were all given residency visas, and 5 months later, aged 19, 18 and 12 years, they flew to Auckland to live with their new adoptive father, Joseph Matamata. Within days of arriving, they were put to work in orchards, often working 14-hour days until 11 at night with head torches, without any pay. The man, whose identity is suppressed, then had to do chores at home and wasn't allowed to speak to his family in Samoa or leave Mr. Matamata's house without permission. His words are translated.
It was like just working, no money. And there was a lot of things that I wanted to go to, but I was not allowed.
He told Crown Prosecutor Clayton Walker that he'd get beaten by a stick, and once Mr. Matamata hit him with a broken bottle.
He broke the bottles and he used the broken one to hit my face.
Above the right eyebrow?
Eyebrow, yeah. My lips were swollen. He punched my my mouth.
He said his 18-year-old cousin was once assaulted by Mr. Matamata because he'd found out he'd asked his orchard boss for some money.
Hit his head on the corner of the dining table.
How many times?
Bafia. It was many, and he hit him with the broom handle, and the handle broke.
The man, now aged 23 and living in New Zealand, said he also saw Mr. Matamata throw a pair of secateurs at his 12-year-old cousin so hard it stuck in his arm.
There was a lot of bleeding and he torn a part of his shirt, covered the hand, and he keep on working. However, the bleeding was excessive, and then Aunga took him to the hospital.
After being treated at the hospital, he said his cousin came back to the orchard and continued working with one hand. He also said Mr. Matamata would order him to beat the 12-year-old.
I would do that because I was scared. Otherwise, I would get beaten.
The man and his 18-year-old cousin eventually ran away from Mr. Matamata's house in November 2018, jumping the tall perimeter fence in the middle of the night and making their way to another relative's house. Under cross-examination by defence lawyer Roger Phillip, the man admitted he had never discussed money with his adoptive father before coming to New Zealand, and he knew from talking to other relatives that had come to New Zealand with Mr. Matamata what life was like. His words are translated.
Yes, they told me, but I still wanted to come to New Zealand.
He said Mr. Matamata was supportive of him playing club rugby while in New Zealand and even won an award for being the best player, despite not being allowed to play all the games. The defendant is expected to give evidence at the end of next week. In Napier, Anusha Bradley.
The autonomous Bougainville government in Papua New Guinea remains confident it will manage to change the constitution in time for President John Momus to contest this year's election. It wants to make it possible for the presidency to be held for 3 terms instead of 2 as at present. Mr. Momus is nearing the end of his second 5-year term, and his supporters want him returned to see through the negotiations over the results of the independence referendum. An attempt to change the constitution last week failed narrowly, and the government has since filed a Supreme Court reference to overturn that vote. The Minister for Peace Agreement Implementation, Albert Punghau, told Don Wiseman it's a matter of democratic and human rights.
So as the president being denied by the floor of parliament, which we did have a majority vote of 25 members voting for the amendment and 14 against, and we just were for sort of one member to the majority. So if you look at it in a real context of democracy and human rights principles, the door was open for the other candidates except President Momus, and that why it's human rights as a citizen, as a person of Bougainville and also Papua New Guinea, not to be given that opportunity to run just like any other candidates.
Although, of course, it's the convention in many countries around the world that presidents are only in power for a certain period of time. For instance, the United States president, 2 terms, 8 years maximum is the standard.
Yeah, if you look at the US and all the other countries that you just mentioned, they have 2 terms in a stable environment where there is no political uncertainty and political Bougainville, you look at it in a different context. We are on a peace process and also a referendum that has taken place where we need unity in all aspects of leadership. And President Momus being one of the leaders of Bougainville, who leaders that started the process and now coming towards the end after the referendum, cannot be just thrown out like somebody who has not contributed. And so if you look at the United States of America, if you look at it, they had no political pathway or for that matter, a referendum that has happened in the U.S. Or that in Bougainville, we have a referendum that has taken place and it was done under the leadership of President Momis. So Bougainvillians believe that United leadership, including President Momis and other leaders and the people of Bougainville, we have a mission, or we haven't accomplished the mission of actually implementing the peace agreement through the consultation and through the ratification process. So it is important that every opportunity must be given to every one of us. Through democracy, of course, not through dictatorship, but through democracy, that all we are asking was that if President Momis can be given another term, like any other candidates, he can be considered by the people of Bougainville. And that doesn't mean that he will win the election. That we don't know, because the people will vote in the democratic election. And if they opt for President Momis to come back and continue on with the work, that democracy does that.
So although there are a lot of people, it would seem, as shown by the vote in Parliament, who don't like that idea, saying two terms is enough, and you're talking about unity, well, it could easily be argued that the approach that the Bougainville government is taking is divisive, potentially.
Yeah, so it is all about unity. I think our concern is we want to make sure that if Bougainville is going to go into this process of a federal referendum, which is an overwhelming vote on independence, 97.7%, and this was achieved through a united leadership, Bougainville leaders, including President Momis and other leaders in Bougainville, and we believe that President Momis would be a leader that would take Bougainville to the consultation and through the ratification process, and then after ratification, we might tell him, okay, you can rest in another election.
But the idea is that you will manage to get a change through in time for this year's election.
Yes, we are hoping and we are confident, maybe as we file the Supreme Court preference, then our lawyers are working around the clock to make sure that they get this thing before the issue of the writs.
That was Bougainville's Minister for Peace Agreement Implementation, Albert Pungau. Fiji's Fisheries Ministry is looking at how to dispose of more than 200 kilograms of high-value fish confiscated during last year's four-month harvest ban. The government banned the fishing, sale and export of all species of kawakawa and donu during their peak spawning season from June to the end of September in a bid to revive their rapidly declining stocks. Last August, the ministry seized 1.2 tonnes of fish, of which 600 kilograms were the banned species. Minister Semi Kroilavisau says three people have been charged after 260 kilograms of banned fish were found in Suva last July.
The issue now is for us to separate the fish that need to be used for the court cases from the ones that can be taken out. We cannot keep it for long because it's a lot of storage area that it occupies now. What we're trying to do is get the legal aspect on the best way to get rid of it. So there are options. In the past we used to use it for feed for aquaculture, but we believe it's quite, you know, a fish that is of high value, and that's why we basically put the ban in the first place. And we wanted to make sure that whatever is available, it could be utilized in the best way possible. We are looking at sell it at a cheaper price, just like a normal government tender where it just put to the public arena, but at a lower price than what is available in the market today. We have to ask the Solicitor General's office to clear it for us to do that. And the main view is that we just can't dump it like we used to dump it before, because the species is of high value. If we can sell it at a special price, then we can have the proceeds returned back to the government coffers.
How many people were charged?
It's about three people.
Has this affected?
Yeah, basically, the ban is specifically to allow them to spawn. That is prime spawn period from June to September. And then you catch it after spawning, then at least it's contributed to the regeneration of these two species. You know, this fish, it's a delicacy with locals and also our international tourists. And if you come to our hotels and to our restaurant, it is the main menu.
Since the ban has been in place, how many people have been dealt
the
with?
The people, yeah, you know, actually monitoring And policing these men is quite difficult because those people that we have been able to catch, it is because they bring into the main market area. What happens outside is basically dependent on our officers that are stationed in various villages. I don't think it is 100% effective, but it is better than the pledge that used to be given under the 4FJ. We used just to pledge that we don't eat Donu and Kaukaua from June to September. We've strengthened that for the fish not to be caught, not to be sold or consumed. That's the difference.
That was Fiji's Fishing Minister, Semi Koroilawesau, speaking with Christine Ravoy. And that's Dateline from RNZ Pacific. You can hear those stories again on our website, rnzi.com. Tofa.